Oh, I'm sorry. I was looking for the evidence that I thought he was going to present. That number one, God exists. That number two, if this God exists, he is the ultimate morality. And three, if an infinitely moral God exists, then he was Yahweh of the Hebrews. You witnessed some familiar tactics, people. My, my, my. I dealt with these guys so many times that I know it's coming. Try to fire a volley of a zillion so-called arguments by your opponent within a period of 25 or 30 minutes to overwhelm the audience with the impression that you're really giving him a good shellacking. If I went out and talked to you individually, I'll bet there wouldn't be very many of you that could even tell me what is in all this stuff that has accumulated during the week. My goodness, I've been teaching English in college for 26 years now. I think I know something about communication. I don't even have time to read through the stuff before he's gone by it and he's on to something else. And he says, I've proven this syllogism and I've proven that syllogism. Well, when has he proven anything? He thinks that he has me over a barrel because he's got this book and I don't have it. And this book can determine objective morality for him so that there won't be any dispute at all over whether a thing is moral or immoral. And that is a crock of it. It just isn't so. Why do we have all of the disagreement in the various sects of Christianity over whether X is moral or immoral? You have it even in the Church of Christ. There'll be one congregation over here who will say that X is moral. Another one over here will say that X is immoral, and they're using the same Bible to make that determination. One of the questions that I asked him the other night, I asked if it would be a good thing for a person to donate his organs to be used in organ transplantation. And he said, yes, under certain circumstances. Well, how did he determine that? Where did God say, under certain circumstances, thou shalt donate thy organs for organ transplantation? Oh, they like to say, well, God gave us his revealed word, and after he gave us his revealed word, then we have an infallible guide to take us through the journey of life, and we don't have to worry about anything as far as morality is concerned. My, 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 that's so incredible that I don't see how he has the gall to stand before you and say that. I make a 30-minute speech. In 5 minutes, he says he's answered it. And he's on to chart 25, chart 27, chart 35B, and so on, and you don't even have time enough to read it. I said, shades of Thomas D. Warren a moment ago, and I think maybe I should say it again. On his questions for me tonight, do you have them so that you can put them on the screen? He made a big issue over number 4. true or false, it is possible that the ultimate being, could be finite in at least one of his attributes. And I said, false. He wouldn't be ultimate if he were finite, would he? Then I turned around and said, but it would be possible to have a finite God. I didn't say it would be possible to have an ultimate God. I said it would be possible to have a finite God. It is, for example, impossible for any entity to be omniscient. How do I know that? If God knows fear, then he would have to be limited in omnipotence. For if he knew that he were omnipotent, he wouldn't have anything to fear. Don't you see? Now, he sees some kind of contradiction in that, but explain to us how that it is a contradiction. It is impossible for any being to be omniscient because he cannot know fear. Because if he knows fear, then he has to be limited in his impotence. He cannot be omnipotent. I'll get it out in just a moment. Because he would have to know that he was limited. He wanted me to start eating on Genesis. If you don't mind, I won't do that because I think I'm under no obligation to do that. We saw another familiar tactic. I told him not to waste his money on Gleason Archer's book, The Encyclopedia of Bible Difficulties, and I'm going to tell you again to do that, not to waste your money. And I'm going to underscore that because you'll see nothing except what you just did here. Come up with some outlandish, far-fetched, how it could have been scenario. Smith's Bible Dictionary has found some root that seems to be related to the same root from which the word Nazareth comes. And he makes a big thing over that. Well, my goodness, doesn't he know that there is little connection many times between the root of a word and how it's used? Let me give you an example in English. Sincere. Do you know what the etymology of that word is? It means without wax. Without wax. Now, what in the world does that have to do with the meaning that we give to the word sincere today? Well, if I wanted to take some of my time and explain it to you, I could, but I'm not going to do it because I have other things to go on to. But he missed the point entirely. I said that Matthew was an unreliable a witness to the fact that Malachi 4:5 had to be a prophecy of the coming of John the Baptist because he saw prophetic fulfillment in everything. I didn't have time to get to another example that I wanted to use in Matthew, the 27th chapter, verses 9 through 10, where Judas took the 30 pieces of silver that he was given to betray Jesus and cast it down before the chief priests. They took the money and they bought the potter's field in which Judas was buried. And Matthew said that was done to fulfill that which was spoken through the prophet Jeremiah, saying, and they took the 30 pieces of silver, the price of him that was priced, whom certain of the children of Israel did price, and they gave them for the potter's field. And I'll eat this book again, Mr. Deaver, if you'll find where the prophet Jeremiah said that. Now, don't come up and read to me a passage from Zechariah that refers to 30 pieces of silver. I know it does, but I know that you have to stretch that passage a country mile to possibly make it the thing that Matthew referred to here? And what good would that do if Zechariah said it when Matthew said that Jeremiah said it? I guess he's going to say, oh, but it doesn't say that Jeremiah wrote it. It says that Jeremiah spoke it. That was one of his explanations for Matthew 2:23 about the Nazareth thing. He said Matthew didn't say that the prophets wrote it. He said the prophets spoke it. And by the way, I want you to notice that Matthew used the plural. He didn't say a prophet said it. He said the prophet spoke it. So it looks to me like you'd be able to find it somewhere. But he wants to make a big issue over the fact that it said the prophets spoke it. So maybe they spoke it and it wasn't written down. Well, I'm going to give him a little Bible lesson. I'm going to suggest that he go home tonight and he read the book of Matthew, and that he notice that more times than not, when Matthew introduced a prophecy, he didn't say the prophets wrote this or it was written. He said Isaiah the prophet spoke this. This was done to fulfill that which was spoken by the prophet Isaiah. And in all of those cases, you can turn and you can find exactly where it was written in Isaiah or the other places where Matthew said it was spoken by the prophet Isaiah or whoever. Now, I don't know if he knew that or not, but if he'll examine the book of Matthew tonight or some other time, he'll see that that's so. The point I'm trying to make is Matthew is an unreliable witness here, and the only proof that he has that Malachi 4:5 was a prophecy of the coming of John the Baptist is the mere word that Matthew said, that Jesus said, that it was so. Talk about hearsay. They'd throw that out in a court of law in a minute. Haven't you ever heard Judge Wapner say, yeah, I can't use that, that's hearsay. Matthew said that Jesus said, and that's all the proof that he has, that Malachi 4:5 was a prophecy of John the Baptist, and we're supposed to swoon over that. Well, pardon me if I don't swoon over it. I'm going to play his game now, and I'm going to skip many things that I'd like to comment on, because I want to get back to what we've been talking about, moral atrocities. And I want you to turn to Deuteronomy, the 23rd chapter, and let's look at verse 1. We've already seen that Yahweh of the Hebrews was a racist God, and I say that racism is immoral. But now we see that Yahweh didn't think a whole lot about anyone who was physically handicapped. Deuteronomy 1, verse 1. No one whose testicles are crushed or whose penis is cut off shall be admitted to the assembly of Yahweh. As my wife said when we were talking about some of these things, hasn't this poor guy suffered enough already? For God's sake, let him into the assembly. Those born of an illicit union, the next verse says, the King James Version says bastard. Those born of an illicit union shall not be admitted to the assembly of Yahweh. Even to the 10th generation, none of their descendants shall be admitted to the assembly of Yahweh. I said y'all was a grudge barrier, didn't I? I hear someone born illegitimately. He can't help that. But Yahweh says, I don't want you to let anyone like that into my assembly for 10 generations. Don't let him in. My goodness, people, how far would you have to go back to get to 10 generations? And did you know, Mr. Deaver, that according to this, David should not have been admitted into the assembly? Because David was a 10th generation bastard, according to the definition. Read David's genealogy in Ruth, the 4th chapter, verses 18 through 22, 1 Chronicles 2, verses 5 through 14, Matthew 1, verses 3 through 6. And let's begin with Perez. He was one of the twins born illegitimately to Tamar, who deceived her father-in-law Judah into impregnating her. That's in the 38th chapter of Genesis that we talked about. So Perez was a bastard according to the biblical definition. He was the first. Hezron was his son. That was the second. Ram the third, Amminadab the fourth, Nahshon the fifth, Salmon the sixth, Boaz the seventh, Obed the eighth, Jesse the ninth, and David the tenth. So David should not have been admitted into the assembly, but David was a man after God's own heart. I have to agree with that, Mr. Deaver. He was. He was a man after God's own heart. Because he did things that are so despicable that they shocked the decency of every civilized person. When he ran away from Saul, who wanted to take his life because of jealousy, he feared him as a political competitor. David went into the land of the Philistines, was given sanctuary in one of the Philistine cities, and he survived becoming a guerrilla marauder. And it was his practice, when he pillaged a village, to take all of the people and put every one of them to death so there would be no witnesses to tell Achish, the Philistine king, what he was doing. And then when David would return from one of these escapades and the king would ask him where he went, he would lie and say that he had done a raid in the land of Judah. Yes, I have to agree. He was a man after God's own heart. Look at Leviticus, the 21st chapter. Verses 16 through 23. And I'm reading this from the New Revised Standard Version because I think it makes clear the point that I want you to understand. This God, Yahweh, had no use for the physically handicapped. In our society, we try to accommodate these people with special accommodations. Special parking. That's not Yahweh's way. Yahweh spoke to Moses saying, speak to Aaron and say, no one of your offspring throughout their generation who has a blemish may approach to offer the food of his God. By the way, I want you to notice how these people thought that when they were offering these sacrifices that they were feeding their God. That's certainly a high plane of morality, isn't it, Mr. Deaver? They thought that they were feeding their God. For no one who has a blemish shall draw near, one who is blind or lame, or one who has a mutilated face, or a limb too long, or one who has a broken foot, or a broken hand, or a hunchback, or a dwarf, or a man with a blemish in his eyes, or an itching disease, or scabs, or crushed testicles. Yahweh had a thing about crushed testicles, evidently. No descendant of Aaron the priest who has a blemish shall come near to offer Yahweh's offering by fire, since he has a blemish. He shall not come near to offer the food of his God, the food of his God. Take notice of that. Were these people any different from the nations around them? Think of Occam's razor again. He may eat the food of his God, or the most holy as well as the holy, but he shall not come near the curtain or approach the altar, because he has a blemish, that he may not profane my sanctuaries, for I am Yahweh. I sanctify them. Yahweh sanctioned slavery. Exodus, the 21st chapter, verses 2 through 6. And I'm sorry, but my time is up. I won't have time to read it.